All right. Today, I have a very special guest with me. It's my good friend, Sanat Soghani, who is a PhD student at Central European University in Vienna. And he studies politics. Let me show you his face. He studies politics. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the intersection of psychology and politics. Sanat and I have known each other for really long. We have been friends ever since our undergraduate days. And we have had similar problems that we wanted to solve in this world, which is the problem of suffering, the problem of why is there so much suffering or pain and evil in the world. But we have taken two different trajectories to solve it. And I have been more on the individual psychology side of life. And Sanat has been more on the side of life, which is political and group level. And so we often, when we meet, we try to reconcile these two worlds. And I thought this would be a great conversation to have on the podcast because it's only so far that we can go with just having like few 5 minute, 10 minute videos. And really my aim here and the aim of the podcast is to have more and more deeper conversations and really solve problems and not just have like some feel good videos out there. So I'm very, very delighted to have Sanat on the show. Sanat, welcome.
Thank you so much, Sankalp. And feels funny. I mean, this just feels like one of our other conversations that we've been having over the last 10 years. But with all this fancy setup just makes it sound more serious. So I'm very, very happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Speaking of fancy setup, I must tell you all that I'm editing this live. So this means I'm doing this all the time. Let's put picture and picture on so that in case I forget to do this, you at least have something going on. Oh, it looks like the picture on picture just disappears the moment I cut. So maybe I'll not have it on. Okay. So everything else is working. So pardon me if the video doesn't work well and things like that. Hopefully the audio will be perfect. And I'm just going to check if everything's working well there. Okay, cool. Right. So psychology and politics. And so I just wanted to start with maybe getting a very quick sense of how do you think these two disciplines differ? Like in the intro, I said that, you know, we are having probably similar interests in the kind of problems we want to solve and kind of impact we want to have. But at the same time, it is two different disciplines. And so what is your very crude sense of how these two things are different?
Yeah, great point. I mean, if I just go back a little bit into history on how we came to this, you'd remember we had founded this political party together back in college. I mean, it sounds more serious than it actually was. But I think the motivation was similar, which was to say, okay, look, we have a very welfare perspective. We'd like to think ourselves of compassionate human beings with some sort of understanding of how human welfare works. So how can we scale that up, right? How can we ensure that's embedded in college life? And I think starting out, my perspective was that, look, you first figure out what the individual needs, and then you just go one by one. But I think over time, I've come to realize that the problem of politics is sort of fundamentally different, which is the problem of how to live together, right? So whether we like it or not, we depend on each other, right? In the more mundane sense, economically, right? If whatever the microphone we are using, the sweater I'm wearing right now, it was probably made in somewhere in Asia, transported through Africa, came to Europe, and I bought it to store. But also, I mean, more interpersonally, like, we like to socialize. You're caught in your room for 2 days and you feel like something's lacking. You are looking for love, you're looking for friendships, etc. But the moment you meet another person, you realize, okay, we need to figure out how to do this together, right? And probably the earliest memory we have is that with our parents. You grow up, you have your own understanding of the world, and suddenly you're like, there are these at least two other people in my house who disagree with me. So how do we decide on what terms to live together? And also the question of who should rule, like even in the household, like after 18, can I decide which college I go to? Is it going to be my parents? And then you can imagine it at the social level. So I guess that's where the two differ fundamentally. The project of psychology, I guess, is to figure out what individual happiness could look like and sort of help push people in that direction. Whereas for politics, you can't really ask that question. The question has to start with, people have all these different conceptions of the good. How do we help them live together on these very different terms?
I see. So what I was hearing you say is that you do think that is they are solving for two different problems, and there are some commonalities and intersections that come with both fields. But I often tend to think that maybe we are indeed solving the same problem, but in different ways. So what do you think on that?
Okay, maybe can you say a bit more?
I'll come to that. But let me just flag one important thing, is because I'm mindful of the listener. And when we say politics, oftentimes the conversation becomes Biden versus Trump. The conversation becomes who's the next prime minister and elections and so on. So it might be just worth first talking about the kind of the brand of politics that you do, which is not exactly electoral democracies. Well, I'm sure you study democracy, but you're not counting votes. You're not doing data science on different, and you're certainly not predicting who the next president is. So speak to me about what political theory is, and more importantly, speak to the person who's listening, who may have some background in listening to this podcast, which is largely emotional psychology based, and why should they care?
So I think the most interesting part is everyone has political opinions, right? Everyone is invested in politics, although some people are like, you know, this is not for me. I don't want to engage too much with it, because we see, I mean, it's often very unproductive, right? You see these politicians debating amongst themselves, just fighting things out to no end. Just going back to this history, like when I got into student politics, so I was this very science sort of nerdy type of guy. I thought what's right and wrong is pretty clear in the world. There are some good guys, there are some bad guys. I want to be on the good side. And I just want to be really good technically to be able to get to those ends, right? Mm-hmm. And that was also my view of politics. So the way we started out was there were some students who wanted to start a student government in the university, but we could see that their intentions were not entirely right, right? They wanted to use it for personal fame, etc. And we know that it would have created a divisive student body. Mm-hmm. And then came me and then a few other students who said, look, we are the good guys, right? We trust ourselves. Yeah. Our intentions are in the right place. We come there, we ensure that it's a good student government. After that, even if I'm not elected, it's fine. The moment I got in, I realized it's not easy to figure out what is the right thing to do, because there are other people who have a very similar view of themselves, that they are good intentioned, they know what is right, but we disagree. I mean, you could take something as simple as, so I was at that time of the view that drugs is a bad word, right? Anyone who takes drugs is a bad person, right? Of course, I still don't condone drugs. Like I can see problems with that, addiction, etc. But my view of the world is a lot more complicated. I would not immediately make that association if somebody is experimenting with drugs that they are a bad person. Right? Sure. So the kind of political theory I do is not talking about drugs, but it's trying to move past these labels, move past these good-bad dichotomy, and trying to ask more fundamental questions like, who should rule? How do we live together? What is a conception of the good? Or the kind of project that I do. So my personal research interests are more in the workplaces, right? So if we come together and work in a certain environment, what are the terms in which we can work? Something as simple as, should people be paid certain minimum wages? Should there be employment benefits? Should there be any sort of hierarchies, etc.? And I think this sort of doing politics should not just be limited to academics. I wish this was how politics was also thought of generally. I mean, you go out on the street and you're like, oh, what do you think about British politics? And these people, they will give you some views. I support the Labour or I support the Conservatives or whatever. And then the other person will give their view and they'll start arguing constantly. And often you'll figure out that if you ask them, what's your common ground? Maybe there is not even that much of a disagreement, right? Mm-hmm. But we get stuck in these labels, whether it's political parties or Trump versus Biden or left versus right, that we are not able to move past and talk about the real issues at hand. And that's the sort of political theory I'm interested in.
Yeah, that's a very good description. And I think it motivates the point quite well of politics is not just something that, you know, like the politicians are concerned about. And both this answer that you gave and the earlier answer, it really is a day-to-day consideration for each one of us, whether or not we identify as a political person or not. And, you know, there's this idea that politics, what an ugly word, like blasphemous. I'd never want to be politician. And there's that shunning of politicians. And what you're saying and what politics is really this unavoidable thing. And it's really something that we have as long as we live in groups and collectives. So just avoiding it is probably not as helpful because we will still be subjected to it. So what this conversation is, and I suppose your whole life has been, is to make yourself aware of what these dynamics are and how we then craft a life which is in alignment with those aims. I do want to give the viewers a bit of a primer, and I did ask you to prepare for this a bit. So I think you're going to be prepared on this. It's just on political theory and politics as a discipline. I'm sure there have been a few key ideas that have come forward right from the days where we were perhaps hunter-gatherers and there was no easy organization of society to today where we live in millions and cooperate in millions. So I'm guessing the engine, the intellectual engine of that cooperation has been a few ideas that has come from the world of politics. So are you able to like just paint a picture of some basic ideas that political theorists throughout the world have come up with and then we'll take it from
there? Sure. I mean, going back in history is a little bit tough. Okay. And I'll tell you in a moment why. But again, let's focus on the fundamental question, which is how to live together. Or we are all playing this game, but what should the rules of the games be, right? And I mean, in popular consciousness, you can think about the ancient Greek idea of democracy, which we still live with. And you would hear that the Athenians used to have direct democracy. So they had a certain justification for it, that if there are 10 people and we have to decide simple things like whether we should construct this building or not, all 10 of them should have a say in it directly, right? That's not the sort of democracy that we live in today in most places where we have representatives, for example. But if I talk more about political theory as a discipline, normally, at least in Western political theory, it's organized in the form of a canon, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure your listeners would have heard of Plato and Socrates, for example. They are usually so. And there's some debate whether Plato and Socrates were actually the same person. But let's assume they were different, right?
Yeah.
And Plato starts in this book called The Republic, the fundamental question, which is what is justice? Mm-hmm. And this is a term that you'll hear political theorists talking about a lot, justice, right? And he spends the whole book thinking about what is justice. And by the end, you're still not sure whether he gives you a clear answer. Mm-hmm. But what he does is reject some hypotheses. So he does not say justice is the happiest society you can have. He says justice is something else. And to be fair, I mean, that's the question that political theorists still are asking. So if you ask me what is justice, I won't be able to give you one-line justification. Then in the canon came someone like Aristotle. So Aristotle focused a little bit more on personal virtues, flourishing, the idea of eudaimonia, right? That you can, in conjunction with society, by structuring your community in a certain way, you can achieve certain high levels of human flourishing. So probably Aristotle comes quite close to combining psychology and politics in that way.
Absolutely. Right? And as an explicitly stated goal,
not yes,
implicitly derived.
Exactly. And that's a debate that you still find somewhere in political theory. So there are the Aristotelians or the Neo-Aristotelians who want to combine the two fields. Mm. And then there is someone like the Socratic philosophers, let's say, right? Who draw this distinction between ideal and non-ideal and who are trying to get at the truth, right? They think the point of philosophy is to get at the truth, whether that makes us happy or not, right? But if they are not really talking about a lot of problems that we face today about how to live together. And then comes in, let's say, someone like Hobbes, right? Thomas Hobbes was an English philosopher in the 17th century, and he's saying, what justifies the king? Right? So there was the British monarchy. And if you think about it, like imagine some aliens coming on a planet or even us going back in time machine and you're seeing millions of people just following this one person, and the son of that person, right? Why? And Hobbes sort of gives you a justification, an explanation for it. And he draws this distinction between a state of nature and civilization. So he does some bit of speculative history and he says, imagine if we didn't have any government. And you ask that question to a person on the street and they say, oh my God, that's going to be chaos because it's going to be a war against war, of all against all, right? If somebody steals something from me and if I don't have a police to report to, what do I do? So we are constantly afraid of each other. And Hobbes basically articulated that idea. And Hobbes was trying to say, and at that time, the English Civil War was about to happen. So he had fled England. And he was saying that, look, you might not be happy with the king, but let him stay. Because the alternative is this sort of state of nature, right? And that sort of thinking still goes on in modern political theory. Although, of course, we've come a long way from there, at least in liberal democracies, where we are saying, yes, we don't want chaos. But also the only other option is not a monarchy, right?
I see.
And then comes in someone like Rousseau, who actually challenges that idea, right? Rousseau was a French philosopher who spent a lot of time in Switzerland. And he said, you know what? You're trying to imagine what a state of nature would look like by looking at people today, right? Who are already born in governments, who are distrustful of each other. But maybe we can imagine a world where there was no government and people were not so distrustful of each other. So in fact, he's saying that civilization has done more harm to us than good. And his basic explanation for that is that, look, there is enough for everyone. At least there was enough for everyone in his time. And maybe one could argue that there still is. If we just think about individual desires, like what I want materially, etc. But Rousseau is saying the moment we enter civilization, he has this very interesting quote that people, you talked about the hunter-gatherer society, so maybe they gathered around a fire and then they started dancing. And then suddenly there was a need for someone to dance the best, right? And there was this need for social competition. And Rousseau says that's what civilization does to you. It shows you a mirror and then it generates all these desires in you to be superior to someone else. And then the problem begins because then there is not enough for everyone. And that's where the conflict starts. Right. So Rousseau sort of comes in and challenges this sort of story.
Sure.
I mean, again, whoever is a bit familiar with these thinkers would know that I'm brushing past them very quickly. Right. But just to give you an idea of how the story has evolved.
Sure. So what I'm understanding is it fair to say that Hobbes was a bit highlighted more of the pessimistic side of what goes wrong and that kind of thing? And Rousseau was talking more of the optimistic side, would that be too much of an oversimplification?
You're not entirely wrong in saying that. Mm. People often read Hobbes as being incredibly afraid of humans and being very pessimistic. But maybe Rousseau cannot be called an optimistic. So Rousseau did not think that the solution is to abolish civilization and go back. So he doesn't think that's possible. But he does think that a refined form of civilization is possible where social competition does not play so much of a role in our societies, right? So there is less of a conflict. But he was definitely, he had a better view of human nature than Hobbes did, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then came someone like Kant. So Kant, and Rousseau said, look, this refined form of civilization basically is where we can live on our own terms, right? We don't have to necessarily follow the authority of a king. We can decide how to live. And Kant sort of tried to flesh that out. What would it mean to live on our own terms, right? And then there are various thinkers. Perhaps another important thinker is Marx, right? I'm sure. So the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx is the second most read book in the world, right? And the first is the Bible. So he was that influential. And of course, there are people who hate him, who like him still, etc. And Marx came in and said that, look, this whole story that you're talking about, the state, etc., it's a very bourgeois story. It's about people who actually own property. If you look at it from the perspective of people who don't own anything, this is not the kind of state we want. In fact, it's possible to live in a society where there are no classes, no sense of private ownership of property, at least means of production. There is no state, and it's possible to live in a society like that. Now comes the big break, right? So if you look after Marx, at least in Western political thought, there is a dead period, right? And the explanation for that is the two big wars, right? Because it's in these wars, people have seen the dangers of grand ideas. So they have seen the dangers of fascism in Germany, and they've seen the dangers of communism. So what people see is that, okay, look, thousands, millions of people got very inspired by these ideas, but the moment you go and try and implement them, you face a lot of resistance because, again, not everyone agrees with it, right? You want a communist society that looks great on paper, but what do you do if not everyone's following the rules, right? And then the society turns repressive. So people said, you know what? These political theorists are ruining our world. They're just giving us grand ideas which are not workable. Right? But then, at least in Western theory, comes someone like John Rawls, who was an American philosopher who served in the US military himself during the Second World War. And he said, look, political theory still has a role to play, but it should be much more humble. Right? So we should start with some basic facts. Those facts are people disagree. There are some people who are not going to comply. And we should keep those facts in mind when trying to think about what a good society should look like. Yeah. And you can say in a way that the kind of political theory that now we do is, or let's say at least I do, which is the analytical political theory, is more in that Rawlsian style.
I see. And Rawlsian style being, it's not too invasive of, it's a bit on the side, there's a much more of a humility
Precisely.
To it.
It's more focused on smaller problems. I mean, it's still in an abstract way, but we are not saying, okay, let's start the society from the beginning and I'm going to paint a picture of a good society. It's not like that. And of course, now political theory is also changing because there were two main criticisms of this canon. So if you would have noticed, everyone I've talked about is a white man, right? So one criticism came from the feminists who said that not only are we only focusing on the thoughts of white men, although there were women also talking about politics, we've also missed out on some crucial things like the family, right? We mentioned earlier, like family is probably the first political institution any child gets exposed to.
Yeah.
And we know from personal experience that who we are is so, so fundamentally determined by where I was born, like where I was socialized, etc. And these political theorists often fail to focus on those sorts of questions. So there came feminists like Nancy Fraser, for example, or Elizabeth Anderson, who said, look, we also need to talk about the gender division of labor and the male bias in Western political theory. And then the second sort of challenge came from someone like Charles Mills, who said this is also based on a very racist taxonomy, right? So if you remember when I was talking about Hobbes, I said there's this distinction between a state of nature and civilization. And a lot of times when these authors were talking about the state of nature, they were saying, look at the Native Americans. Look. So I think Locke even has this quote that the king in Native Americans is worse off than a peasant in Britain, right? Which is to suggest that, look, we have made progress, they have not, right? And that sort of thinking some ways is still pervades Western thinking.
Sure.
So then there was this sort of political theorist who said, no, look, there are other systems of thought. There is an Indian political canon, there is an African political canon, there is a Latin American political canon. First, you also need to pay attention to this. And second, you need to acknowledge that what you're saying about what state should do differs vastly when it's applied to the UK as compared to when it's applied to India, right? Because India has had to reconcile with this 200 years of a colonial past, for example. So yeah, to cut a long story, very long story short, there is a canon, and this canon is more to tell you like how the kinds of questions we ask has evolved themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suppose... Well, first of all, thank you for painting that. It's not an easy task to go through all of political theory and then paint such a clear and beautiful picture. I suppose there's just, for good reasons, you have not included anyone like Confucius. And the reason would probably be that in the... first of all, there's just too many of them to talk about. But also, is it fair to say that they do not get as much attention in at least the academic style of work that you do, or they've obviously not been not influential, because if you go to China, everyone will know who Confucius is and will be influenced by those ideas. So is it the same thing that the feminists were saying, that we've sort of left them behind through a male-centric white bias? Or do you think it's something more to do with ideas that they were not applicable in the West or something like that?
Yeah, Yeah, you're absolutely right about someone like Confucius or let's say Gandhi and Ambedkar in India. Like we are familiar with it, but if you ask political theorists here, even like, I don't know, people who have been teaching for 20 years, they would often have not read those theories. And I think that comes from a bias in Western academia where they would say, yes, Confucius and Gandhi were saying something important, but they were saying something important about China and India. So they get regionalized. Whereas when you read Hobbes or Locke or whoever, then there is this idea that, look, their ideas can be applicable everywhere, right? And to some extent, there are being some attempts being made in the Western academy to challenge that, right? We are thinking about how to integrate these other non-Western thinkers into the main canon. As for the feminists, the problem is slightly different, right? They were saying that, look, in the same house, there were authors who were writing, just their writing was not being publicized, right? And they were also writing something that's very relevant to your own context, right? It's very relevant to your own family. So they were challenging more this bias. And that's why I think to some extent, feminist political theory has still made a little more headways. I think feminist movement has been a bit more successful in that way, where you can see that political theory has become a lot more responsive to those demands now.
Beautiful. Yeah, I just wanted to pay homage to our homies back in Asia, Confucius, and because obviously they've had big impacts, but they often tend to be ignored.
All right.
Thank you for this beautiful introduction and this sense of the history of politics and the key ideas. And we also touched a bit on the Eastern side of life. I do want to talk a bit about so what you do and sort of come into what you do a little bit. So of these amazing thinkers from Plato to Aristotle to Hobbes, Marx, Kant, etc., what are the thinkers or who are the thinkers who have influenced you the most, and why? And why do you think one speaks more to you than the other?
Yeah, it's always hard to point out because definitely all of them have played a role in shaping my thinking. But if I go back to my formative years, which is the first time I encountered political philosophy, I remember being very influenced by Kant. And it was actually about something that doesn't strictly classify as political philosophy, according to some, where he's talking about ethics, right? So he has this idea, which is, so maybe your listeners are familiar with the idea of consequentialism. So consequentialism is the idea that if you have to evaluate whether something is right and wrong, you just look at the result. If that makes people happy, if this is the right result, the action must be right. And Kant is the exact opposite of that. So Kant is saying, look, if you agree that being honest is the right thing to do, it is the right thing to do, even if it leads to disastrous consequences, right? And I think that struck a chord with me, right?
Yeah, I sorry to interrupt, but I have to say, one of the things that I'm always quite struck by when I listen to UK politics is just the use of the word "that was the right thing to do." And so now, why did you do that? Because it was right. And to a consequentialist, that may not make sense, right? What do you mean it was right? Like, did it lead to some benefit? Like, did it help me? Did it help you? And the current Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, often says, so things like, you know, he did not cut taxes right after he was elected, or nominated in this case, because it was the right thing to do for the country. So is it correct to say that this is Kantian, and this line of thought is Kantian?
The language is. I wouldn't necessarily say that Rishi Sunak is Kantian, right? But you're right. That's the sort of thinking. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that example shows it's probably a bad way of doing politics, right?
Yeah.
So the bad
way being that you can just say that it's the right thing to do and just fail to justify your actions with any more substance.
Exactly. Because if you're dealing with the public, right, if you're in the public sphere, there is this requirement that you have to tell people why it's good for them. Mm-hmm. You can't just be like, I'm an honest person, I'm a good person, it just felt like the right thing to do, and so I did it, right? So there's definitely morality in politics, which is why we do political theory. But it's not just about my personal morality, right? And that's also one of the reasons why I like Kant, right? He pushed me in this direction, but he also made me think how much bearing this has on politics, right? And actually, the other strand of thought which has influenced me a lot, and I haven't mentioned this here, is Buddhism, right? Now, some might argue, like, is Buddhist philosophy really political, right? Now, for me, all philosophy is political, right? Mm. It's talking about the person and how to survive in the community. Mm. And if you remember, I think probably the first time we started having these conversations a lot was when you introduced me to meditation and we went on a retreat together. Mm. And one of the things that I loved about the retreat, of course, apart from the fact that it introduced me to meditation, to mindfulness, was the theory behind it, right? Mm. So there were these 1 hour lectures every evening, which I used to look forward to a lot. Mm. And the meditation teacher would talk about things like the Sangha being the community, and them saying that, look, although this path to salvation or enlightenment might be an individual one, but it requires a certain community. Yeah. And I remember, like, at the end of the retreat, or was it at the beginning? I don't remember. But I came to you and I asked, look, Sankalp, you have all these wonderful insights about Buddhism and how it can lead to individual flourishing. Mm-hmm. But what does it say about politics, right? Mm-hmm. And I still haven't figured it out exactly. Mm-hmm. And to me, in some ways, Buddhist philosophy is a consequentialist philosophy, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
It's opposed to Kant in that way. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it, I mean, they would pretty much agree with the same virtue. So they would think honesty is a virtue, yeah. etc. But they're less rigid about it, I guess, right? They're talking more in terms of, look, honesty is a virtue because you generate less suffering, even in yourself, when you're saying the truth, mm-hmm. or something like that. I'd probably ask you that question again. Like, do you think Buddhism has much to say about the sorts of questions we've been discussing?
All right. Yeah, we're getting into the guns now. So I think the first... I actually remember that retreat day very clearly even today. And so for the audience, so we both were doing this silent meditation retreat. It was a 10-day retreat in Pushkar in Rajasthan, India. And either on the first day or on the last day, we had this conversation of, is the purpose of the government, the state, just to build more meditation centers, as a metaphor of, and that was your question, as a metaphor to mean that, is all the government and the state doing is facilitating individual development, or is there any
function
of the state?
Yeah, wow, you have a brilliant memory. You're right. Yeah,
that is true. Well, the brilliant memory or the question was very pointed. Let's just say one of them. I think that is a question for you to answer because you're the political theorist in the room, which is, have you figured it out? Like, can the state do anything more than building more meditation retreats? But I would say on the earlier point of Buddhism, it's hard for me to say whether it has like political implications, but it definitely, what you said, that it has a very strong theoretical foundation, which is very attractive. So I personally, bit of an atheist, don't believe in God. And I think I often say that if I had to choose one religion, and I'm in that case, I'm born with this, but if I had to choose one religion, I would probably go with Buddhism. And in some weird ways, not that I'm making any comparisons here, but Ambedkar also did the same analysis. Yeah. And to an extent, the reason why I am born with Buddhism is his decision back in the day. And I don't want to get into too much of that because I know we have a global audience. So I don't want to go too much into the history of why I am a Buddhist. But having said that, this you know, the debate between Kant and who's the consequential? Mill, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. These two debates, to me, it strikes very similar to the debate that I might have with someone who is more religious, which is we are coming from two different places on our understanding of virtue and morality. Like, I would be like, you know, this brings happiness, this brings joy to the different parts of you, which is like the psychological side of life. So well-being, eudaimonia. And someone might say, you know, God said so, or this is how you go to heaven. But if you look at the actual things we would probably agree on, which is honesty, let's say. Like most religious people would think that honesty is good. So there is something about the actions are epistemologically irrelevant, like where they come from. Like your final arrival point is the same in a lot of the cases. Now, I would love for this to be the case for all of the cases, but that's where I think the disagreements come in, which is it's not the case in all of the cases. And of course, there's extremism with religion. And I know I'm going on a bit of a complete tangent with your question there. But there are people in this world who would justify violence under the name of religion, even today, right? And I personally think that's where these two branches of political thought don't meet. It's in these cases where there's, from a consequentialist perspective, it's relatively hard to justify that, but from a Kantian perspective, it's relatively easy to justify that as long as you are agreeing that God indeed did say so.
Interesting. I'll probably push back on that a little bit, because in the modern political theory, this debate usually manifests itself in the form of something known as deontology. Mm-hmm. Deontology being this branch of politics that focuses more on duties, on what's right, mm-hmm. etc., and utilitarianism, mm-hmm. right? Utilitarianism, it's a subset of consequentialism, and utilitarianism, broadly, the idea is we should do things that maximize happiness.
At this point, I would like you to just briefly say what utilitarianism is and consequentialism is and deontology is, just so that we keep everyone with us.
Deontologism is broadly what I described Kant is doing, right? So in the political arena, what deontologists would usually focus on is, for example, rights. So when you go to a court of law, normally courts are not saying which decision is going to make someone happier, right? They just look at the law and they say, these rights were violated. You had decided that these rights were not being violated. I don't care whether it makes you happy or not, right? Although in practice, often courts do care about the consequences as well. But they are sort of based on this deontological framework, right? Yeah. Consequentialism, as I said, is broadly the idea that what we have to care about is the end product. So you put it beautifully, how we get to that does not matter as much as the final arriving point, right? Mm-hmm. And then utilitarianism is sort of a subset of it, and they've come up with a bit more specific definition, which is utilitarianism is whatever satisfies your desires the most, for example, or whatever satisfies your preferences the most. So within utilitarianism also there are further divisions, but let's just run with one of those, right? If I have a chocolate and if I have, let's say spinach, and let's assume both are equally healthy, if chocolate is going to make me happier, I should just go with the chocolate, right? It's almost, I would be stupid and I would be doing myself wrong if I still went with something that does not make me happy or that does not advance my well-being in any way, right?
Sure. Yeah. So deontology, go by the book. So that book could come from God there should needs to be a book, but go by something, some higher sense of true or what's good and so on. And consequential is more of a, what's the byproduct? Like, what is our end goal, and does it maximize that end goal? For example,
exactly. You've put it exactly right. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, a lot of people currently oppose utilitarianism because mm-hmm. they think it's the more dangerous one, mm-hmm. right? And that manifests itself often in these trolley problems, right? Yeah. So maybe listeners are familiar with this. If you watched, I highly recommend this Netflix show, by the way, The Good Place. I think if anyone's broadly interested in the kinds of things we are talking about, and if you want to juggle with philosophy, it might be a nice place to start. And the trolley problem is basically an idea, is a hypothetical problem, which is, let's say there are two railway tracks. One track, there are three people. The other track, there are two people, right? And suppose you see a trolley that is running in the direction of three people. So you know that trolley is going to kill those three people. And you have a lever where the only choice you can make is to turn the direction of that trolley, right? So now if you turn it, it's going to kill two people, right? Now, should you turn it? Utilitarianism gives you a very clear answer. It says, yes, you should turn it, right? Yeah. Because you're saving three lives and you're killing two people. Mm. Now, of course, you can have all sorts of questions about, are those two people happier, depressed, more moral? But let's assume all five, their lives are almost equally worth living, right? But a deontological person or person concerned more with the good and right would say, look, it's not just about two people and three people. It's about what you are doing. Like, so imagine there was this trolley that was running in the direction of three people. It was an accident. Those three people get killed. You don't feel guilty. You turn this lever and you kill two people, their blood seems to be on your hands suddenly, right? So imagine their family member and coming and telling you, so their lives didn't matter to you just because there was one less person, right? So and you can imagine this manifesting itself in larger problems. So imagine wars, right? So are we allowed to sacrifice the interests of a fewer number of people for the sake of larger number of people? So if a country knows, let's say there is a terrorist group, it has to drop a bomb, it's going to kill five innocent people, but at the same time they know that it's going to reduce the chances of a future terrorist attack, should they drop the bomb? And utilitarians, just by their reasoning, seem to have a very easy answer that they should, right? And in politics, it seems like we have reasons to just step back and say no. Also because we are often not certain of what the consequences would be like. So that's... I know we have strayed a bit away from Buddhism, and also it would be false to say that Buddhism is just a utilitarian philosophy. I think it's much richer than that. It's going to say much more than that. But that's, I think, how the debate is taking place in Western philosophy.
Yeah, and just to make the debate a bit real, I think this sort of a trolley problem situation reared its head a lot in the COVID times, especially in the beginning of the pandemic, where there were a limited number of beds. And I do remember reading these protocol sheets that many hospitals had to issue about who do you pull first, like whose ventilator do you pull first. And so just to flag that these discussions can be very real also, and not just these theoretical problems. So do you remind me what you asked about Buddhism once again?
I think we were collecting. Maybe the reason we are straying is because we haven't figured out a clear answer to this question still, which is, so Buddhism clearly has a lot of insights on individual flourishing, right? It is saying something about metaphysics. It has the no self hypothesis, right? It's challenging the idea of free will, right? It's also saying something about how exactly to engage with your own desires, which is not to repress them, but also not to necessarily, you can say more on that, but to give in to them, but more to stand aside and observe. And the path to enlightenment is this realization of no self in a way. Now, when we put it like that, that's clearly a very individual journey, right? And if, let's say, we were living in a society where most people agreed that this is the path to happiness, right? How exactly should they shape their political institutions? Now, the question is one, the symbolic building of meditation retreats, which is we just ensure there's a community where people can reach this sort of goal. In some ways, Gandhi had this idea. So Gandhi basically thought that politics is good when we have more and more virtuous people. So for him, the fundamental site of politics was his ashram. He thought that if just more and more people could learn to be virtuous, to be in check of their desires, to not give in to especially the baser desires, then we would have a better society, right? But that sounds like a bad way of doing politics, right? Because clearly that our social institutions are a lot more about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is... even in Buddhism, or there's this question of there's only a limited percentage of people who grow, so to speak. I know I'm going to be very broad, and of course you are not that person because you're listening to this podcast. But we've all had this experience of, on average, people tend to be static and difficult to change, and it's a bit of a pessimistic argument in that way of saying that, you know, most people will not want to grow psychologically, or, and this is irrespective of the Buddhist context. Like, by growth, it could simply be like physical growth. Like, you know, how many people are fit? It's probably going to be like a small percentage of the population, and most people would be unfit. And again, not to say good or bad, but that just is the case. And I guess the same goes with mental health and emotional intelligence and so on. It's, I think that's the first thing that comes to mind. That it's probably like, if you're just relying on everyone getting enlightened metaphorically, or even being somewhere along that journey. And here, I want to note that I'm not just saying enlightenment in a Buddhist context. I don't consider myself Buddhist day to day. I do some meditations. But what I mean is just like achieving high mental health, let's say. Most people will probably not be on that path, sadly. I mean, I would love for everyone to be there. But, you know, most people go to therapy, they realize it's not for them. Most people will try meditation, they'll be like, the meditation is not for me, and so on and so forth. So it sounds like we can't rely on individual virtue. Now there's the second problem of psychopathy and sociopathy and bad actors generally. And it seems like it's unrealistic to expect that there will be no bad actors ever in society. Even if you give them meditation tools or whatever, perhaps there is something genetically, maybe, like there are some genes. I understand that code for psychopathy. I'm not an expert at it. So, yeah, I think that these two problems come to mind with the Buddhist solution. And of course, there's problems inherent in Buddhism also. So it's not just, you know, like, okay, let's imagine ideally everyone adopted Buddhism. Again, Buddhism, I'm using it metaphorically. It could take therapy, take whatever. Mental growth is what I mean. There will be problems inherently in whatever school of thought you're coming from, be it the Western psychotherapy school of thought, which, let's say, might place too much emphasis on sitting on a chair and writing down your emotions. And it may not put as much emphasis on going out and acting. A bit of an aside, obviously. I was listening to this podcast on mental health recently, and especially the problem of men's mental health. And this problem, quote unquote, tends to be a bit more resistant to the therapy solution, because I think there's a lot more desire for action, like a lot more things to change rather than just talking about emotions. Yeah. Or that at least is one part of it. So I think that's the second problem, which is we don't have a school of thought that is comprehensive, be it Buddhism or Western. And I think the best we have right now is study as much as you can and then try to understand the mind.
Great point. And I guess here, at least I am speaking as I think, so we'll know in hindsight whether this was good, right? But what you're pointing to is probably something that I said at the beginning, which is politics has to confront this problem that we disagree about what happiness is and how to get there. But also there is the second problem, which is more epistemic problem, as you pointed out, that maybe none of us have fully figured it out, right? How to get there, right? So in under such a circumstance, for us to have a comprehensive conception of this is what going to make people happy or healthy or whatever, and then have our politics reflect that, is not just going to be wrong probably, but also dangerous, right? It could lead to, again, this revival of grand theory and just some people saying, I am pretty convinced of these things and let's run with it, but that not working out in practice. So that's also why, I mean, you asked me which thinkers influence me right now. So I think I would very much place myself right now in this Western liberal analytical sort of political philosophy, which draws on Rawls, right? And Rawls, one of Rawls' main ideas is this idea of political liberalism, which says that we need rules which can accommodate as many reasonable conceptions of the good as possible. And the emphasis is on the reasonable. So you mentioned society is going to have sociopaths and psychopaths, right? So maybe they want to live in a society where, you know, they really enjoy people fighting against each other, right? And maybe that's the sort of society they want to see. But that's not a reasonable conception of the good for most of us. So Rawls would not accommodate that. But what Rawls would accommodate is There are some people who are going to be religious who think following the word of God is the best way. There are other people who are going to say, look, living my life to the fullest, just on a very moment-to-moment basis, just maximizing my desires is the best way to live my life. Mm-hmm. And we need some rules of the game which can accommodate both of them, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the sort of political philosophy I'm also attracted to, which is I want to appeal to as many reasonable people as possible, mm-hmm. while, of course, coming from my own position. So there are certain values I really hold dear, like equality, for example. So how can I ensure that that value gets pushed through while appealing to as many reasonable people as possible?
Yeah. I suspect at this point, a lot of people will be thinking that all of this is good and interesting indeed. But maybe theory is theory in terms of it might be too distant from me. So I'm just imagining the average listener to this podcast is probably driving. And if you're audio, then it probably stayed in the US somewhere. And if it's video, it's likely not driving, but somewhere in India. And then there's listenership across. So my question to you is do you find that reading political theory has had any benefits on your more personal life? And has it helped you as a person in any ways? And if people were to invest time in understanding more theory, political theory, would they benefit in any way?
I think it, again, connects to our first question about the relationship between politics and psychology. Definitely, it's helped me personally, right? I think the most mundane point here is that it helped me understand that my parents are not always right. Or the kind of beliefs that I grew up are exactly what they are. They are a set of beliefs, right? Some of them were right. So I grew up a vegetarian, and I'm happy I grew up a vegetarian, because now, having considered those beliefs, I would like to continue being a vegetarian, right? And that is a political philosophical belief, right? So I considered animal welfare, I considered like what we owe to other beings, other people, and I arrived at this judgment that this is good, right? But there are some other things that I would not agree with, right? Which is, so let's say my parents have this belief that up until the age of 25, they are best placed to take decisions on my behalf, right? Something as comprehensive as who my partner should be, right? And they would want to have a lot of say in it. I hope my parents never listen to this podcast. but that's a belief I've come to reject, right? And again, I think that's thanks to political philosophy, where I've come to appreciate that, no, look, once you enter this phase of adulthood, and maybe that line shifts for everyone, but let's say we have agreed on this 18 years of age as the benchmark, after that, your life just goes much better when you can take charge of most of these own decisions. And that's also broadly what liberalism is based on, right? Where we respect individual judgment, even though I might think it's wrong, right? Simplest example might be, if I come across a person who's not such a good friend of mine, they are smoking. And I'm pretty sure I've done the research. I know that with them smoking, especially if they're smoking 10 cigarettes in front of me, their chances of contracting cancer just go up. So I know what they're doing is bad for them. Still, I do not have the right to just snatch the cigarette from them and throw it away. I have the right to convince them. They have the right to not listen to me, right? So there are these sort of terms of interaction which are there. So I think political philosophy has really helped me become a lot more clear of the why individual judgment is so important, right? And then other than that, I've always been this sort of person who's been very troubled by the world around me, especially growing up in India. Inequality is something that deeply bothered me. If I'm coming out of a restaurant, I don't know, spend, let's say, if I talk in terms of pounds, having spent £50 on a meal with my family, and I come out and I see this person who's begging for £1, right? And that £1 could have given them a meal. And that just bothers me. Like, why do we live in such a world? Like, have I done something so much significantly better that I get to have this fancy meal and this person does not get to eat? So how did we arrive at this situation? And that sort of political philosophy has helped me understand, like, how do people sometimes legitimize these inequalities? So people might say that, look, of course, everyone should have access to food, but maybe that beggar just did not work hard towards it. Or there are some other people who are going to say that, look, everyone is willing to work hard, especially when it comes to feeding their stomach. Yeah. If they're still begging, there's something that must be wrong with the system, right? So just to get these sorts of explanations, right?
Yeah. It's very interesting because the things that you were describing, I would have arrived at the same insights, let's say, but taking a more psychological lens. So maybe this will speak to the intersection of psychology, politics. So the first point, let's say the cigarette snatching example, I would be tempted to say something like agency is very important for mental health. So we know of this by studies, and in my own research, I take a little bit of this, which is the more the sense of agency someone has. So even if they do not have agency in the grand scheme of things, and you know this comes to the free will topic, which we can or cannot discuss. But let's assume if there is no free will, just that you feel that you have agency is important to feel happy and feel good about your mental health and feel good about yourself. So even though I might think that based on my value system, which is valuing health, that cigarette might not be good for this person, they still have the agency to create their own value systems, in which case it may be okay to smoke that joint. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't need political theory in that sense to justify that. And again, I do think that it actually intersects with the larger point, which is morality, which we'll come to in a bit. But that's agency. And the second thing about inequality you were talking about, the psychological side of it is there seems to be a very strong emotional response we have to status and social mobility, which is moving and up and down social ladders. And again, if you look at mice, there's some studies done on this where they essentially make them fight. And the way to make mice fight is you have like a tube in which two mice come from two sides, and the dominant mouse basically asks the other mouse to go, and the non-dominant mouse sort of makes way, retreats. So if they're meeting at the middle, you can often find which the dominant mouse is based on who gets way and who gives way. And then you can also cut open their brain. Well, a bit grotesque, but that's what happens. And then you can see parts of the brain where there are tangible differences between the dominant mouse and the other mouse. And you can knock off that part of the brain and that behavior goes away, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to remember. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this particular study focuses on this part of the brain called the hypothalamus and the habenula, which are involved with like day-to-day processes. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the neuroscience of it. But I guess this intersection point we are talking about is the same things that you were justifying based on your political theory study. I could come at the similar conclusion purely on the argument of mental health and happiness and joy and living good life. So do you think, are they two separate things, or do you see there's some common thing there?
Great. First of all, I want to say that this sort of discussion is very productive, and especially if any listener is very inspired by it. I think this is also an underexplored dimension, both in political philosophy, definitely, but also I think in psychology, right, where this sort of intersection. So if you just go back to this example of cigarette snatching and agency, right? So you're definitely right. And that's how often these consequentialists or utilitarians say that agency is important, because feeling like I'm in control makes me happy, right? But at the same time, there are other instances where we think that it's okay to paternalize people, right? So we definitely think that states should intervene, at least in a lot of circumstances, to prevent people from committing suicide, right? Or sometimes, to take even a more banal example, right? In a lot of countries, it's mandatory to wear seatbelts. Although if you think about it, whether you wear a seatbelt or not does not harm anyone else but you, right? But the state somehow has this authority to say that if you don't wear a seatbelt while in a car, I'm going to fine you, right? Which is the state basically making a judgment on your behalf. So all I'm trying to say is that there are some cases where we do think that this sort of paternalism is justified, which I don't think we can differentiate between those two cases when it's justified or not without engaging in some sort of political theory, right? That's sort of one of the more fundamental problems of political theory. And then the second example, Sorry, I'm missing. What were we talking about? The second example.
Status.
Oh my! That I think that's like the heart of the issue, because that's also where both our dissertations come into picture, right? So I think when we talk about social status, my own research focuses on social status and workplaces, right? Mm-hmm. So broadly, I'm interested in this sort of questions. I'm sure if your listeners in the US and in India especially, both will know that when you go and meet someone, one of the first questions you ask them is, what do you do, right? And if they say, look, I work in a supermarket versus I work in the Pentagon, right? Or if I work in the Rajya Sabha or whatever, you have vastly different opinions of them suddenly, right? The way you relate to them, how much you want to talk to them changes completely, right?
Yeah, the student version of that is I went to Oxford.
You went to Oxford versus I went to some obscure university. Yeah. But exactly, right? So we made those sorts of status distinctions all the time, right? And then there are two questions to be asked there, right? Three, actually. One, does that sort of status distinction make anyone happy, right? The second is, should we have such status distinctions in the society, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a question that we need to address at the level of politics? And the third is, are they inevitable, right? So third, when you talk about this experiment with mice, right? That's sort of what would we you seem to be hinting at, that we've seen this in a lot of species, including hens, mice, that they have this pecking order, right? And humans definitely too. So is this even a good goal to try and get rid of all these sorts of social hierarchies? Mm-hmm. But let's say we admit that biologically we are somehow wired to make these status distinctions. Should they reflect in politics, right? And to a large extent, we have gotten rid of those. Like, to take a simple example, in India, growing up, you would remember that if there was a car with this red light on top, right, everyone had to stop and let them pass through, even if this minister was not going for anything official, right?
Sure. Red light is often used by government officials or ministers and so on. It's similar to like a police car, but just red.
Yeah, exactly. And they were called VIP cars, very important persons, which was to signal that somehow they are more important people than us, so they should be allowed to pass through first. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, a lot of states in India have made that practice illegal. So now, at least some of the more lower level ministers are not allowed to put those in the cars, which I think came with this public acknowledgement that, look, okay, fine, there might be social hierarchies, but this is not cool, right? If you're a public official, you should not be allowed to claim some sort of superiority over the rest of us. And then there is this third question, which is, does it make anyone happy? Of course, it does not make the inferior person happy, but does it even make the superior person happy? Going back to Rousseau, right? Where Rousseau said that suddenly when I have this need for self-esteem, I'm engaged in a social competition, which maybe in my sleep, I don't even care about it, right? And it's also unstable. Like, I guess everyone can relate to this feeling where you are in a room full of people. You don't want to be subject to their esteem, but you somehow are, right? You are in a conversation and you have this sort of inherent desire to leave an impression and maybe to even come out as the better person in that room. But at the same time, when you're talking, you don't want that need, right? So how exactly do we relate to that? Do we just pander to the feeling, or do we sort of say, look, you try to train yourself and not worry too much about it. Like, when you're talking to someone, try and not think too much about the impression that you're creating. So I guess that itself is also both a personal and a political question, right?
I think so there is, on one extreme, there is the school of thought that there should be no hierarchies whatsoever. I tend to be a bit skeptical of that school of thought, precisely because of the how natural I think it is. And you referred the pecking order. There's basically no cooperative species that we know of that doesn't have some sort of hierarchy, and let alone humans. And secondly, as I said, there seems to be some relationship. So the other thing I did not mention in the whole mice thing is also you could see that the you could so I suppose in that study, if you could flip the social hierarchies, you could flip their happiness overall. So that means that, you know, there's some sort of, when you climb the ladder, there is a sense of happiness and joy that comes from that thing. And maybe the capitalist will be very happy to hear that, right? Because that's the whole American dream based on social mobility. And if you have a completely flat structure, then you lose that dynamicism of life. You leave that zest, perhaps. So I guess that's the psychological side of life. I think what binds all of this together is morality, this topic of morality. So I do want to spend some time on that, and let's see if that helps us. I mean, I don't expect us to resolve any of this, right? These are broad, open questions. But where I have found psychology and politics to meet very well is this idea of morality. So even in our discussion today, we were talking about good and bad multiple times, and it's a interesting question to ask. Where does that good come from? And we did touch briefly on this with God, and perhaps it comes from there. But if you are not happy with just invoking a supernatural power, then that question becomes really interesting. And one way to talk about it is to talk about good is what is healthy, good is what is mentally healthy and happiness and brings happiness and joy. So I guess maybe I should just ask you, where do you think good comes from or bad comes from?
Great question about what's morality and what's the relationship between the good and the morality, right? Mm-hmm. Again, one of those questions that's unresolved. Like, it's something that we disagree with about a lot. I guess the first thing to say it, that we have a sense of what morality is, right? And children have it, right? Children have a sense that what I'm about to do, should I do it because it's going to make me happy or mom happy or dad happy? But also sometimes I should do it because it's the right thing to do, right? Now you could argue that if you think about it, that always collapses into what's good. So, I mean, you'd often come across these examples of a child being brought up in a non-vegetarian family, right? And this five-year-old suddenly has this realization that the thing that I'm eating was a walking animal, right? Mm-hmm. And they suddenly don't want to eat it anymore, right? Now, I would interpret it as their moral self suddenly talking to them and saying, look, this is not a value I can hold dear. Mm-hmm. But you could also explain it as them saying they're just disgusted by the idea of harming another being, mm-hmm. right? And maybe the two ultimately mm-hmm. collapse. Right. But for me personally, I think they come apart, right? Because there are certain things that are hard to explain, yeah. right? So maybe, let's say we found out somehow, let's say psychologically, that there is just that immense pleasure that we derive yeah. from killing other people, right? Yeah.
This is going to go well on YouTube.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't believe that at all. But let's say philosophers often talk in hypotheticals for good reason. But even in such a society, or let's say not even killing, like just hitting other people.
Yeah, that's better. Right? Yeah, that's better. I'm scared of the algorithm like being like this. These people are talking about. Yeah. Yeah. So let's say flipping off others.
Yeah. Exactly.
Putting others down. Yeah. I mean, it's fine. I don't think YouTube is that sensitive.
Putting
yeah.
others down. So let's assume something that we don't value, right? Mm-hmm. We would still say that it would be a bad thing to normalize that mm-hmm. in the society, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there are some people, which is often known as moral relativists, mm-hmm. who say, yes, we have this sense of morality, ultimately, it's just super subjective. Mm-hmm. It depends on what you feel is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And I remember we used to have going to say something that YouTube might not like, but we had this philosophy professor, and wherever someone would say, oh, but morality is relative. So he would ask, so you think some people are going to say that boiling babies is fine, right? Mm-hmm. No. So if all of us agree that there are some acts which are yeah. bad, not because they mean some harm to someone or whatever, they're just bad, right? Mm-hmm. That suggests that there are moral truths in this mm-hmm. world. And I think that's what I believe as well, right? And I usually don't like to draw a very strict line between human beings and other kinds of beings, mm-hmm. because I think And that's probably also where a little bit of my Buddhist influence is coming from, because I think the welfare of all beings matters. But if there is supposed to be a dividing line, I think it is this, that human beings have a capacity to think in terms of morality, right? Human beings have this capacity to just abstract, through abstract reasoning, say that this is right or this is wrong.
Sure. Yeah. I've actually spent a lot of time in this podcast talking about morality and good and bad, because I think answering that question is critical to good mental health. And the reason why I think that is not necessarily these theoretical case scenarios, but it's about, we are making these decisions about what's good and bad for me all the time, right? And if there is something that I think is good, let's say through the word of God, which doesn't coincide with what is good, let's say emotionally or mental health wise, then that is where the birthplace of suffering is. So you are doing something under the influence of some authority or somewhere it comes from. So I think for me, that's why things do boil down to the first principles of psychology. And I guess the more famous statement here is mind matters most. And that's where all the mental health and feeling good and feeling bad comes in the picture. The other point I want to flag here with morality is, are you aware of this author's work, Jonathan Haidt? Have you heard of it? I think you probably should. I think his framework, he has this moral foundation series. A lot of psychologists today also use that sort of a decomposition of morality. So I think he says, and many others do, that morality breaks down into these five components, let's say. One of them being compassion, care. Other is hierarchy, disgust. And there are a few others that I don't recall completely. And I think his framework is particularly good for reconciling the differences that people have in what's good and bad. So, for example, for the record, let's say there's one person who is more conservative and the other person is more left liberal, let's say. They are obviously going to have disagreements, hence the conservative liberal. And a lot of times the conservative will think that the liberal is wrong and the vice versa. The way a Haidt's thing will resolve that conflict and say that, look, they actually have two different brains, so to speak. They have different palates. For the conservative might have more of the hierarchy function in them, so they might be more sensitive to hierarchy. Like, you know, some person might be more sensitive to disgust. We all know the person who is wants to keep their rooms absolutely clean all the time, and then we all know people who don't want to do that on the other side. And each to them has things that the other is completely absurd. And the way Haidt would say is, look, this person has a palate for disgust more than the other. And I find that to be very good in terms of reconciling our moral differences and knowing people are different, perhaps by design or maybe upbringing or whatever. Regardless, this question of good and bad, I do think is a central question to answer to live happier lives. And is that something you would concur with, or would you think it's a more tangential philosophical?
I don't think it's tangential at all. And probably that's a good way of leading. Because one of the things that morality assumes is free will, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right, I mean, we can't talk about free will right now. We'll be here for another 6 hours. Yeah. But it's also a question that we can't fully answer for sure, mm-hmm. right? You could always explain my actions by saying that, look, it's through your socialization, biological makeup, da da da. And I can also say, look, no, there is this slight moment of agency. But if we don't want to get lost in that, right? At least one thing you and I can agree on, that is, our values really matter to us as people for our own well-being, right? And by values, I mean like moral values, right? What's the right thing to do? It really makes our personal life go well. If you and I can agree on that, I think that's still enough for us to say that something like political theory matters and an active reflection on what's right and wrong matters, right? So maybe I'm happy to run with that.
Yeah, I think we'll Since this is a rabbit hole, I'm gonna we'll leave it at that. You have recently gotten engaged.
Congratulations. Thank you.
I need to show your face for that.
I don't know if my partner will ever end up listening, but if you are, hi.
How has that decision, so you were together for a long time, but how is that political, it's a political thing, right? Like marriage is an institution. How has that changed anything about you and the way you live life?
Wow, excellent question. And I think you're right. So that's also one of the clarion calls of feminists, that look, the personal spheres, including things like marriages, are a political institution. You're right. Now, of course, me falling in love with this person was not a political question. It wasn't me being like, is this right or wrong? It just happened, right? And then I endorsed it consciously. I said, look, getting into a long-term relationship with this person just is going to make my life go well. Mm-hmm. So in fact, it would be a bad idea for me to evaluate that mm-hmm. through a moral lens. Mm-hmm. But now we are taking the next step, which is to announce to the public saying that, look, we are married, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a political decision in two ways, right? One is we are asking for legitimacy. We want other people to acknowledge that we are together. Mm-hmm. But also it's a more political thing in a more pragmatic way, right? We want to claim certain kinds of state benefits. We want to claim like a spouse visa, things like that, because we are married partners. So I think marriage is a great example of something that is a seemingly personal decision, right? But is also political in the sense, because how well your married life goes well depends on this community, right? So if I live, let's say if my partner was from a different religion, to some extent she is, but let's say if we were coming from two different backgrounds and our surrounding was not happy with us coming together and getting into marriages, I'm sure readers in almost any part of the world will relate to this experience. Our decision to announce it to the public would really could make our life go worse, right? Because if we are going anywhere and if we are not getting the right social legitimacy, like people are not willing to talk to us, maybe if we have a child, they don't want to sit with them or whatever, mm-hmm. right? It just makes my life go worse.
Yeah. Having announced this decision to the world, has anything changed in day-to-day life? Have your relatives been different with you? Have your friends been different with you?
I think I can sew more 6 months later when I'm done with the wedding. But it's definitely made my life more complicated, right? But personally, we still went ahead with it because broadly, we are still in a setting where it's probably going to add more to our life. And again, the rules of the game are structured such that in a lot of states, in fact, married people get more benefits than single people, right? Again, something that we can think about whether that's a good way of organizing society. To give you an example, if I'm going to Europe tomorrow, and I want to say that, look, he's my friend, right? He wants to come to Europe for a conference. You should allow him to give him a visa because we want to spend our time together. The state is going to say, no, we don't care about that. But if I bring in my partner and say, I'm married to this person, please give her a visa or him a visa, the state says, yes, we can, right? So the rules of the game are structured in a way where certain kinds of relationships get privileged over other ones, right?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, the state recognizes it, basically. That also applies to nationality, right? It's like if you're a citizen of a country, that's somehow recognized by a government now. Whereas, you know, the person still is that person. There's nothing that's added on that person per se.
Marriage is a great example of also that if you sign up for that institution, you're accepting the authority of some people, right? You're accepting the social authority, as I mentioned, but also in many cases, religious authority, right? So I am also a person who self-identifies as an atheist, like at least I definitely don't believe in priests, etc., mm-hmm. right? But the way your marriage often gets solemnized is mm-hmm. through a religious leader, right? So in that way, it feels like a compromise to me, but also at the same time, the way our society is structured right now, not necessarily in terms of laws, but in terms of norms, I need to get this yes of that religious authority to go ahead. And I think a lot of our personal decisions are similar, right? Sure. Which university I go to attend, it's not just driven by whether it'll give me an educational qualification. It's also driven by how well are my future employers going to recognize this institution? So it depends on this community of people giving certain legitimacy to my decisions.
Sure. Yeah. If you were to give someone advice on when they should go with the state and when they should conform, essentially, and when they should rebel and be have more of their sense of agency, do you have any pointers on it? I mean, if you want, you can take a example of, let's say, marriage or some anything that helps you, or if feel free to roll with it, give a general answer, whatever.
Personal advice. So, again, if we are to live with others, sometimes we have to accept their terms, right? So I would definitely not be in the camp where I'm like, if you don't like something, you just disobey, right? So especially with more banal decisions. So maybe you like driving on the right, but you're forced to drive on the left. It's just good to drive on the left because that's how we are going to be able to cooperate, right? So I would say that if there, it's something that's not too fundamentally conflicting with your value system, it's okay. But if something else is, right, maybe it's not even affecting your life personally, but let's say you really believe in the freedom of choice when it comes to partners, and you don't want to live in a society that really looks down on homosexuality, whether it's through laws or through norms, right, then maybe you even have a duty to yourself to resist, to maybe participate in protest movements, etc., maybe sometimes to disobey directly, to talk to your fellow citizens, convey. And I think that also brings me to a point that maybe I didn't clarify enough in the beginning. Politics is not just about the politicians, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually ultimately about convincing your fellow citizens, right? Mm-hmm. And a good way of doing politics is not to get caught up in the labels, mm-hmm. not in left, right, not in this politician, that politician. But if you come across a person, right, mm-hmm. whom, let's say, self-identifies as a conservative, you want to identify as a liberal, mm-hmm. move past that label, right? Mm-hmm. Ask them, so what do you think about this question? If they disagree with you, and if they are a reasonable person, let's try to argue that out. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's going to solve all the world's problems, yeah. but I think that's the best bet we have to yeah. live in a world where, which is of our own choosing.
Yeah, and you know, partly that is, so not that we disagree on a lot, but this format of conversations, I think that's why it's so powerful that we can come together in conversations like this and try to let our two worlds meet and learn, essentially. Like, that's been the process for me. Like, I've learned a lot just by the virtue of having this conversation. I do want to start wrapping a bit, but there's so much territory that we did not touch. Like, I want to talk about the different styles of politics, like identity politics versus, because we've been talking about self-identifiers every now and then. On this example of, you know, like, let's... It's not ideal to be just perfect rebels or perfect conformers, either side. I think many people will resonate with it. For example, here in the UK, again, I'm not trying to side with either side here, but a lot of people do agree, let's say, climate change is a thing. And given that, there are some people who are protesting on the streets, sometimes to the with Just Stop Oil, for example, being extremely disruptive with, let's say, spraying paints on paintings. And then there would be people on the complete other side who would probably think that that is counterproductive, in fact. Like, you're not convincing anyone. So is it fair to say that all of what you're saying would apply to a situation like climate and how we convince each other about what's good?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a specific issue that we'll have to talk more about. But my personal view is protests have to be disruptive, right? Because protests are meant to bring attention to something that's part of your normal life. You go to your office, you take out your car, you don't get time to think about how much carbon footprint that car has, right? So someone comes in and forces you to stop and get attention. Now, we can argue about what's the best form of getting that attention, right? But I think my general view is that if you come across as a protest, especially once that's disrupting your life, rather than trying to think of it as, oh, these people are making my life go worse, the better thing to do is maybe they are trying to catch your attention to something that's it's not going there because you're so preoccupied with other things in your life.
Sure. Yeah. And that's a rabbit hole we will not get into. Right. I do want to ask about, so if people listening to this conversation get inspired and they're like, I want to learn more about theory, what would be some like good starting points, like books or
The good thing now is philosophy is in the pop culture, right? So I already mentioned the Netflix show, for example, The Good Place. If you want to get a good sense of like, you know, what philosophy looks like in a world. If you want to do more academic style political philosophy, maybe Plato's Republic is a good way to start. It's a very accessible read. There is a very good resource known as Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy online, especially if there are some terms that you want to read more about, like utilitarianism or things like that. Then that's a good place to get deeper into those terms. And otherwise, I mean, philosophy is all around you in movies and books. You don't even have to engage with analytical philosophy. There are creative writing books that you can read. I mean, I think one book that we've both read is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right? I think you've read it. It's not written necessarily in the form of premise, conclusion, right? But it's a very deeply philosophical text. So I think you can find resources that appeal to you.
It talks about quality, which I doubt if our cameras have today, and if everything will be captured. That's great. And is there anything, so we have time for maybe like one thread in a couple of exchanges. Is there anything we should be talking about we haven't?
Maybe, I don't know if you've zoomed in enough on the left-right spectrum, because that's sort of dominated in the politics right now, right? So I think one way people, when they say, okay, look, you're right, politics is not about representatives, so I have to place myself on the spectrum somewhere. And I'm not saying that's an entirely bad spectrum. The problem is when you think of, let's say, a lefty, right? Maybe you imagine somebody dressed colorfully, maybe with colored hair, maybe with a pride flag on their car, maybe they are a vegan. You imagine somebody on the right and you imagine them suited up, you know, very traditional, very well-mannered, very, very disciplined about the rules. Now, the thing is, maybe it's right, but like all stereotypes, they're bad heuristics, right? So I think my personal opinion is it's a bad way of organizing how you look at the world. When you come across someone and their politics is going to be revealed in the first 2 minutes, they're going to say something and you're like, oh, I can see what sort of a person they are. But resist that sort of judgment, because people are very complex beings. And you'll be surprised at, you might think that, okay, if they believe, let's say, eating animals is right, but they might have a very different view about animal welfare, right? So I think just, there's some sort of more compassion that's required in the political conversations of today.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point that we did not touch, and we absolutely haven't done justice to the classification system. And I know there are plenty of those, and I guess we're going to just leave this for the listener to figure out. But I agree with you. There's when I was doing my undergrad, until that time, I would be happy enough to be classified as left. And, you know, there was some sort of group identity that came with it. But I think part of my growing up has been to just answer that question as I'm nonpartisan. And, you know, like, let's talk about issues and let's talk about what might be the topic at hand, rather than just, you know, bucketing someone or myself in that case. And not only is it useful for like the social image that I create, but it's actually useful for my own thinking, because now I'm no longer committed to one side. And I can actually engage my faculties fully. And sometimes the solutions can involve aspects of both sides. So I think oftentimes in academia, there could be the bit of a demonization of the right, and same the other way around in other circles. And I think neither side benefits with that sort of a stereotype.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So I think this has been fantastic. This is the time where I get to thank you for coming along, and thank you for just like laying out this land. I made plenty of notes, as you can see. I'm sure the listeners would be quite enjoying it. And also perhaps you gave them a bit of food for thought. So not only is it nice for me to listen to, but I hope people also enjoy it. And I think the one reason why we wanted to do this is because it will sort of keep some record of our conversation. Our views have changed significantly right from Ashoka. And also a lot of things have stayed the same. And so this is nice to have this record. And next time we meet in person somewhere, we'll do this again, so that how many ever months or years that is, we know how we are growing and changing and what are the insights we're having.
Thanks a lot for having me here. I think this also gave me a chance to revisit some of my own basics. And you're right. I mean, I don't know if, yes, I want a record of this, but maybe 10 years later, I would listen to some of this and be like, no, I mean, what was I saying, right? And I think we have to be open to that kind of change. But also, I'm very happy to have had this conversation, and I hope your listeners also find it helpful.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. Bye.